Welcome to Law Subscribed. This is your dedicated news source for all things subscriptions and the law. My name is Matthew Kurbis. I'm the subscription attorney, and I believe subscriptions can help bridge the access to justice gap and incentivize attorneys to modernize and scale their practice like never before. In this episode, I interview Liam Moriarty. Liam is the founder of Lawgood, a legal tech company using the subscription model. We discuss his founder journey, what it was like to leave practicing law to start a company, pivoting that company, and innovative partnerships leveraging the Lawgood software. Liam even shares about one time Above the Law wrote a story about him. It's not what you think. Thank you to my sponsors, 650 and Gavel. Links to both in the show notes, more on them later. And remember to use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED when signing up. You get 10% off, and it supports the show. The best way to support the show is to share it with someone you know. This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only, and nothing said is legal, ethical, or financial advice. Without further delay, here's the episode. Liam Moriarty, welcome to the Law Subscribed podcast.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Well, I'm happy to have you. Finally, we're both fathers, and family things always come first, which is easier to do when you're not a big law attorney billing hours, right?
Very true. Very true.
So, but we have had a chance to have a conversation and get to know each other a little bit. But for my listeners, could you please give yourself a little introduction?
By way of background, I'm a lawyer, went to Columbia Law School, and then practiced at Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, based in New York, but did work mostly in New York and London for a few years. Then left Big Law and went over to Peking University and joined their graduate faculty teaching legal rhetoric, legal writing, and deal documentation. And then came back to the States and founded a company called Lawgood with a couple of friends, one of whom she's a much smarter lawyer than I ever was. And the other one is my best buddy from college. So that's just a super short background on my legal career so far.
Well, you're all smart because you're not billing time practicing law anymore, right?
Correct. Absolutely. Yeah. I've left that behind. I am a lawyer in recovery.
Congratulations on the other side. But the company name, Lawgood, I think when your everyday person maybe thinks of the lawyer or the law, they don't always think of the word good coming after that. But so why the name?
Yeah, well, we went back and forth quite a bit and we actually started with started building a slightly different product that was much more so geared towards lawyers who were dealing with freelancers. I had a relationship with the Freelancers Union in New York. And so we were developing this initial product after I came back to the States. And a lot of the freelancers that I had worked with or had some connection with through the Freelancers Union, we were brainstorming after one monthly meeting, and the name kind of popped out of there. And that product never really came to fruition, really. But we did keep the name for the product that's now in market. So yeah. We just liked it. It grew on us after a while. We weren't so sure about it at the beginning, but it grew on us. I had plenty of taglines I wanted to use, like law bad, no law good, but they never got off the cutting room floor. So,
oh man, this warning listeners, this might be a dad joke.
That's right. Oh yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I have consumed and I'm trying to start to contribute to the Freelancers Union. They do a lot of great stuff. And I have a connection with Chicago area freelancers. And I now actually moderate a group called Scaling Freelance on .com, Scaling Freelance. There's almost 500 freelancers in the group or just solopreneurs. And so I like we've done a lot of content that's what the Freelancers Union does. But it's a great group, though.
Yeah. Absolute yeah. I got involved with them, I think, in the early 2000s. I think it was the first, after graduating college, it was the first place I got my health care was through the Freelancers Union, and then kept with them, and they did some really great, they pushed some great legislation in New York, helping protect freelancers, pushing for them to the hiring companies to have written contracts so that they weren't able to just not pay these freelancers or take advantage of them.
It's like freelancing.
Freelancing
isn't
free. Yeah. And they've been doing some work out here now in Los Angeles as well. But yeah, and they have a big hub in, I think it's Brooklyn or maybe Dumbo.
I think so. Yeah. And in Illinois too, we've had a similar, I think they passed a similar law inspired by the Freelancing Isn't Free Act in Illinois as well. So it's had a massive impact, the union across the states.
Yeah. And it's certainly not really doing anything with it right now since COVID, but just to give them a plug, it's an easy organization to join. It's not a true union, more like an association. So
yeah. Yeah. It's like a free association to join.
Yeah.
but then they accept donations because it's like a nonprofit or quasi nonprofit.
I think it's a nonprofit, but yeah, they accept donations and they give resources to freelancers and things like that.
And I'm glad we were talking about that too. And I am curious about what the original product was. We won't get too into it because it's not relevant anymore. But like one of my three buckets that I serve through my law firm subscription attorney LLC is freelancers, because really like there's huge market opportunity there. And like unbundled services in particular, because the freelancers still want the relationship with their clients. So they don't want you negotiating things on their behalf. So like unbundling, like, okay, legal advice and a per page, $20 a month, $50 a page to help them with their contracts is something that they really like. And then if they're wheeling and dealing and they've got three or more contracts a month, I stopped counting pages if they want to sign up for my freelancer packages and they just want per project, right? So then it ends up being more affordable for them. I get a little bit more recurring revenue, and I mean, they love it because now they could focus on their art or they could focus on their skill or whatever thing that they're doing, and they don't have to worry about the legal stuff anymore.
Yeah, that's a super necessary offering. I think where we were, the rub for us actually was our product right now is a drafting platform, very much so geared towards lawyers and in-house teams. What we were playing around with back then was essentially, it was much more of a review product, contract review, and we were using different machine learning models at the time. So not generative AI or transformer models, but convolutional neural networks specifically. This was even before Legal Burt, which was an impressive model that was the mainstay in legal machine learning before generative AI now, but we're using something called Spacey and trying to essentially have this model kind of follow a lawyer going through a decision flow, trying to figure out what they should be looking for in independent contractor agreements. And really the technology, the volume of contracts when we were getting started to train up the model, the volume of contracts that was necessary wasn't really there. And probably at the time, the technology wasn't really there. It was a little complicated. We were trying to get this model to essentially skip steps in this decision flow to aid the lawyer in doing this kind of work more quickly. But it wasn't exactly there. And we've heard from a lot of lawyers who were kind of servicing this market that their pain point when dealing with freelancers wasn't so much the review side of things where they were doing just a couple of reviews a month. It was more on, hey, how can we draft these kinds of contracts in an easier, more efficient way so that we can transfer that cost savings over to these cost conscious clients. And so that's really from that kind of product and what we were trying to do there. That's how we came to the Logbook product as it is today.
Yeah, I mean, and pivoting is actually like a really important lesson. But before we even get to the pivot, I think that it's still a great idea. And there are companies now that are doing that. One that comes to mind I learned about because I spoke at Stanford's Codex, the online version. Not the in-person one. I spoke at one of the online ones. And one of the speakers with me was a co-founder of a company called Kaveat, spelled K-A-V-E-A-T. And they are essentially what you just described, but for like influencers, content creators who are essentially solopreneurs. Some of them build a team, but it's just for that, those types of contracts in that space. Yeah. And they're using like the most recent machine learning models, which you just didn't have available to you at the time.
That's right.
So like the idea was great, but maybe a little too early, but drafting still super important. And really like I consult with like VC firms and some other legal tech companies from time to time, but mostly potential investors. And like, they're asking like, what is the next platform that like helps lawyers more efficiently draft contracts in light of all this generative AI stuff? Right. And so like, you guys ended up in a decent space. I think it's okay.
Yeah, it is. It's an interesting space. And it's, I would say in the last year or so, I think it's become even more interesting. But
yeah. So the decision to pivot, which I think is relevant to my listeners here who might be billable hour attorneys who want to pivot from billing their time into a new business model. Now, while you maybe were still planning on charging a subscription, which is how you charge now, we'll get into that, you did have to pivot even the product that you were offering. And I will say, when you change your business model as an attorney who's billing time to subscription or subscription and flat fee, you also need to change the product of the legal service that you're delivering too. So I still think it's an important lesson for my listeners, even though it's not specific to law, the legal services. So like what goes through the process of deciding to pivot from one thing that you thought you were going to do to now you discovered a better idea of more of a market need, and now you're pivoting to that instead?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, I would say that there's big pivots and small pivots in certainly kind of our software product, but any small business owner, I think, it should always be on the lookout for pivoting. So certainly somebody who has their own practice or anything along those lines. It is, I would say, oftentimes it's not always the easiest thing to do. It's certainly not, it can be, I would say, a painful process. Like I was building this product, loving it, but not really finding that I was getting to product market fit with what I really wanted to do. Still really believed in it, still thought it was super fun to play around with and try to build and try to make it work. But our early clients or our beta users were really telling us that they needed something else. So for us, we were fortunate enough to have early users that we could rely on kind of their feedback and really to get a much better idea of kind of what, certainly our target market was small to medium sized lawyers and small law or small to medium sized law firms, folks who oftentimes are priced out of some of the big enterprise legal tech software products.
Yeah.
And just from our experience, that we found that some of the big transactional practice resources that were out there, even not to name any names, but big legal publishing companies that we've all probably played around with their tools when they were free for us in law school, and get a little sticker shock when we're possibly going into practice for ourselves or see how much they cost. So for us, we had a fair number of users who were telling us, look, this was actually where my pain point is when I'm servicing this demographic. And so that really helped us understand that we should be kind of moving the product. And it was a slow process. I think I was still trying to build as we were slowly moving away and building the next product. As it was, the first product was a little bit of my baby, so it was hard to be able to yep. give it up overnight. But yep. when we started getting, it was a slow process. So when we were getting some new traction with the new product, kind of more on the drafting side of things, it made it a little bit easier to recognize that I needed to focus on something else. And we all needed to focus on the new product and pivot away from the old.
Yeah. And so you had to still then three founders.
That's right. Yep.
So you all needed to agree on it too.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was, I mean, we were a small team. We're still a small team. And each one of us definitely had to buy in. I think I was the one that had to go a little bit kicking and screaming, but I got there eventually. But it was really because of customer feedback was the thing that put us over the edge and helped us know that we should be pivoting to something else.
So then before we get into like what LawGood is today in more detail, let's do a little bit more of your story. So sure. You mentioned the firm you were at. Is that Big Law? Is that like a big law firm?
It is a big law firm that's based out in Ipsen, Dunn & Crutcher. It's based in Los Angeles. Kind of their three big, I mean, maybe my information might be old, but there are three big offices. It was a big old California firm. The New York office was pretty big. And then the DC office had a lot of Supreme Court litigators and things like that. And so those were kind of the three big hubs when I was there.
And at the time, I mean, like, what were you expected? Like 2,000 hours a year minimum kind of a thing?
Yeah. I mean, I'll say it was never explicitly put to us, right? But I think it is, we were definitely along the lines of the industry standard at the time. I had to do quite a bit of travel for work. I was on a case that had me 2 weeks in New York, 2 weeks in London for about 3 years.
Yeah.
So there was, at least for those first couple of years, there was a lot of work to go around. It wasn't hard getting to that, but meaning getting to that billable hour, kind of what is market for a billable hour, for how many billable hours you need in a year. But it certainly was very disruptive. Work-life balance, having to travel every 2 weeks and working those long hours and things like that.
Yeah. I mean, look, I started a family when I was billing time. I don't know if you had like started a family at the time, but could you imagine like where you are now, like want to spend with your kids and your spouse, and like there'd be no way we're still billing time. I mean, could you imagine, like, aren't you glad you moved away from it into academia
I don't know, 26 or something like that. I didn't have a family at the time. I wouldn't have been able to do that at the time. At one point, I gave up my apartment in New York to save extra money so I could put towards my loans. And I was living in an RV. So when I would come back to the States, I was in an RV. I got picked up in above the law that I did. I was interviewed by somebody for a New York, I think it was New York Magazine offshoot. And then like a David Ladd at Above the Law saw it and said, like, this person's a lawyer, and found who I was and where I worked and put it in Above the Law. I don't know if it's still up, but it was pretty funny at the time. But yeah, it was, I mean, I can't imagine working in big law with the life I have now and the time I want to spend with my family and things like that.
Yeah.
I know people who do it, but I think there is always a kind of a trade-off.
There's a trade-off when the only way you're making money is time that you're spending working, right? Yeah. Where it's synchronous only. Now, of course, Lawgood has a different business model than billing time because it's a legal tech company. But so tell my listeners, what is the model?
Yeah, so we're subscription-based. We're a SaaS software solution. And for the most part, we do have people come, mostly smaller law firms or smaller in-house teams, find us and use us directly and pay monthly. But we also now partner, our bread and butter has been partnering with larger partners or larger legal publishers that don't have a transactional product offering per se. And so we slot into their offering to be able to provide their users with transactional practice resources, essentially a drafting platform that they can use to draft contracts.
And so I heard in our pre-interview conversation, you referred to it as gray labeling the Lawgood product, which I hadn't heard that term before. So like, what do you mean like by a gray label exactly?
Yeah, so it's definitely not, it's not just kind of, it doesn't look exactly like Lawgood does if you were to find us kind of and sign up for us directly. And it's not exactly what we would consider a white label where we are building a solution specifically for these partners. It's a gray labeled solution in that we modify some of the user experience, what the platform looks like for the user based on where they're coming from. So we may incorporate one particular types of content depending on where the user is coming from, what part of the user is coming from. And we'll also usually try to incorporate some of the partner's design elements into the product. But it's a pretty light touch. We tried to keep the platform pretty nice and clean so that we can do this and be pretty flexible depending on who we're working with. So, and then also usually the name. So I think for Wolters Kluwer, which is our largest partner, our product offering is Vital Law Agreement and Clause Builder.
Yeah. Okay. And then, yeah. And so the Powered by Lawgood thing though, that's sort of where like the gray labeling comes in. So
that's right.
Yeah. I'm on the website right now. So like it's perfect. It's the Wolters Kluwer's website. If you search for Vital Law, one word, you see it that it's all Wolters Kluwer's. It's their website, it's everything. And then it's their trademark, their registered trademark, Vital Law. But then underneath that in smaller font, it says Powered by Lawgood.
That's right.
So there's your gray label. So it's both their brand, but then still you get the shout out as what's powering the solution.
That's right. That's right.
Super interesting. Super interesting way to like diversify the revenue, right? Because you've got the very reasonable subscription for Lawgood for like small firms or small in-house teams. I mean, very competitive for other small firm solution type pricing. Not that there's a lot of competition in this particular space, but as far as what other legal tech products are selling to smaller law firms, this is that sort of price range. And prices are subject to change. So it's up to you, Liam, whether you want to say your price is live or not live, but recorded, but it's up to you.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, we do, it's right on the rack rate for us is $89 a month, but we do quite a number of promos, especially for folks who are coming to us directly. And we're a monthly subscription. So we certainly have a number of users who they go through, they're drafting ebbs and flows depending on what time of year it is. So we don't lock people into a year subscription or anything along those lines for those folks who are coming to us directly.
Also, not a flexible offering that you'll get from these bigger legal tech products that we've all used in law school, which is the reason I don't subscribe to them.
Yeah.
Because my legal research needs ebb and flow. And they really only let you subscribe to all their other offerings when you're subscribed to the research platform. But you also do something that I'm a little jealous that law firms can't really do a true version of this, which is you actually have a freemium model because you've got the free version and then you've got the premium version of that. So your paid subscription is the premium to your freemium. So why even have a free offering and how did you go about designing that?
Yeah, so we found too from a good bit of customer feedback that where some of the hesitation for subscribing was that they hadn't been the individual, the lawyer hadn't been able to try out the product first. And so we wanted to be able to essentially take a kind of a small piece of what our product was and allow the user to try it out so that they could play around with it, see if it worked for their practice before subscribing, kind of going full bore. So that was the idea there, was to allow users to be able to kind of essentially test out the product before having to subscribe, as again, small business owners, which are small firm owners, cost conscious. And we also wanted to make sure that people weren't subscribing by mistake or subscribing thinking they needed this or thinking they would like the features and things like that, but then getting in the product and having a bad experience. So we wanted to make sure that we were set up to allow people to test us out before signing up or paying for us.
Yeah. Yeah. I am curious, just from like a business model perspective. And again, you don't have to reveal specific numbers if you don't want to, but compared to the way that you generate revenue from the other partners, not necessarily just Wolters Kluwer's, because I'm sure you have to change it up based upon the size of the company and how much they're using it based on servers and backend stuff that I don't fully understand. But is that like a usage meter? Are you also just, it's a subscription, it's a flat amount every month? Like, how are you choosing to monetize that relationship?
Yeah, so we do a couple of different, we're pretty flexible again, because we're pretty small. So with different partners, we do have different relationships. Our preference is usually doing, again, partnering with these large organizations. We reach a lot more users. It helps essentially power our data engine, which is one of our, we think is a big value add for us, being able to start teasing out what our market standards for particular contract types, clauses, industries, geographic locations, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And for some of the larger ones, it's essentially changed over the relationship now. We launched, I guess, about 3 years ago, started getting kind of some bigger clients about maybe 2 years ago, bigger partners. And now I would say, like for our first partnerships, those contracts have kind of changed and grown in the last 2 years. So our preference is usually kind of like an OEM model, a one for one, where we're trying to find partners where we will be added to their existing bundles. And then we get essentially a license per user. So each new user of X partner becomes a new user of Lawgood automatically because we're added to their platform. And that's, for us, that's a big, why we push that is we are a small team. We're also a point of need product where it can be, we don't necessarily want to spend tons of our time convincing our partner sales team to push us at the right period of time, as opposed to we can just be added to existing bundles and then they can talk about us as a value add for those bundles, but they don't feel a need that they have to kind of really push us and sell us on top of everything else that they're already selling in that bundle. Right. But we do then also reseller agreements where we do kind of rely on partner sales teams to push us. But, you know, for the most part, we've just done kind of it's usually a negotiated flat rate per user at per year for these partners. And then it kind of depends on how many users the partner is bringing to the table and a bunch of those kind of factors to go into what the price per user is.
And I mean, I got to imagine those partners of yours are charging subscription pricing.
They definitely are. They all are. And it definitely varies. In some cases, we do know how much they're charging for their kind of full bundle. But in a lot of cases, we really don't, because they are constantly changing around their bundles. Are you subscribed to labor and employment and M&A, or just labor and employment and IP practice areas or whatnot?
But for you, you don't want to manage all those different variables. If you get a flat rate for every single user, I mean, in a way, it's a rev share, except it's not a percentage base. It's just a flat rate because like they get the user, you get the rate per user. And I mean, it's a really elegant solution to solving that problem.
Yeah. Right? Just use it. That's right. It usually just requires, I mean, one it is always, I mean, I think, especially in the beginning when we were first starting to negotiate, it was an uphill battle just because these are usually, I would say all of our partners are much larger than we are. So just in any negotiation, there's a lot of kind of push and pull. And then, yeah, I mean, it really depends on, for us, it's just kind of, it usually extends the negotiation out because that's what we're really pushing for. And certainly what we care about with some of these deals or with most of these deals.
Yeah. Yeah. When I went solo, I pivoted from mostly litigation to a transactional-only practice. I did not have a database of documents to automate. That's why a business and employment legal document database and automation tool like 650 is super useful. I can rely on the quality of the documents in 650's database since they're putting excellent legal minds to work curating and updating their documents and automations over time. When you're not billing by the hour, outsourcing and efficiency matters, and 650 can help you scale your practice to get high-quality documents drafted in less time. Use the code LAWSUBSCRIBE at 650.com and when being onboarded to get 10% off. If you're not a business and employment attorney or you have your own documents that you'd prefer to use, then my next sponsor, Gavel, is the automation tool for you. Gavel allows you to build shareable, client-facing workflow and document automations. In other words, Gavel helps you create a legal practice where attorneys can monetize the value they bring clients in productized form and scale via subscriptions and flat fees. Use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED at gavel.io to get 10% off an annual subscription. There's no one right way to automate and scale your practice, but with one or both of my sponsors, 650 and Gavel, you can take your subscription law firm to the next level. Links to both in the show notes. Now back to the show. It's really interesting. Like, so instead of, because these companies could certainly just like go out and build the thing that you're doing, but that's going to take massive time and investment and probably a larger team than what you're working with in order for them to fit it into their system. And then that's going to divert their internal resources from the things they're actually good at, which is the other stuff that they've been doing for so long. And so it does make sense to, instead of paying a huge amount, right, just subscribe to you guys on a per user basis based on their own subscribers. And like, this is an important thing, like to get through to the attorneys who want to use the subscription model, is when everyone's pricing on the subscription model, like, it just makes it a heck of a lot easier to manage the business. And so like, when you are charging your clients on a subscription, now you can more easily perceive, well, I could pay for all these other subscriptions that help me power my practice, that help me do the thing that I do to serve my clients. And so like, the fact that Wolters Kluwer's and these other companies are charging on subscription, which then makes the relationship, they know that they can't afford a per user to pay LawGood in light of what they're charging. And if you're asking for more money than maybe what they think, then they can maybe slightly increase their subscriptions to their end users. And it doesn't make a difference to them because they're still making the same amount of profit, because a small iota of change at the end users might not create a lot of churn because it's just a small increase on their end. So things get adjusted and stuff. So, I mean, like, this is part of the beauty of the subscription model, in my opinion, is how nice it, how it keeps everything simple along the chain of commerce, wherever you fall in it.
That's right. Yeah. And it can be, I mean, depending on the business, it can make things more flexible. As you said, certainly anybody on a subscription can kind of change based on usage or offering and things like that. And it's, I think oftentimes it can be, I don't know this, but I'm sure there's books on it, but it can be perceived as better by the end user because they're saying, oh, okay, it's not, why am I charged? You're doing this kind of research. Why am I being charged this number of hours at this rate for this and this number of hours at this rate for this, as opposed to saying, well, I'm getting this offering here and it's X price, but the offering changes and it either expands or contracts and it's Y price. And it kind of intuitively makes sense. And I think the other point that you made is correct, right? We're small and we're pretty nimble. And a lot of these larger partners, I mean, absolutely, they're battleships. Is really what they are. And they can, it takes a little bit of time to turn that battleship. And there's a lot of different departments that have to sign off and agree. And there are competing, there may be competing priorities for a limited number of resources. So oftentimes, and then always building a new product, even for larger, big, successful companies, can be scary if it falls flat. And just as with any company, there is a non-zero chance it's going to fall flat. And so it kind of de-risks it by saying, okay, well, we're going to partner with somebody like LawGood, for instance, who has a product, who has users, who has other partners that are, luckily for us now, who has other partners using them. It's not so risky for them to say, look, we're going to test it out with our users for this set amount of time. If it works and our users love it, fantastic. If it doesn't, we haven't really had to kind of go on this big diversion where we're changing priorities and wasting resources and doing that.
Right.
So that's definitely been our thesis too, is why it's easier for a lot of these places that don't have an offering like ours to partner with us, because we can really slot into their offering very easily without disrupting too much of what they're already doing.
And because you have experience doing it with a company already, like now it's not, I'm sure it's not as simple as plug and play, but it's going to be a heck of a lot easier for customer 20 in that you're doing that for than the first five.
Absolutely. Oh yeah, definitely.
And there's value there. And the reason I've been pulling this thread and talking about this is because I want my listeners to extrapolate this example into, this is your pitch to clients for whatever you do for them. And it's going to be a heck of a lot easier if you're like doing fractional in-house counsel work like me, but even like everyday people, it's like you could slot into their life so that they never have to worry about a legal thing ever again. And now they've outsourced that to you for a fair monthly subscription, yeah, right? And they are the one user that's paying
absolutely
in this instance, right? And so like that is like that same concept, I think, can be extrapolated to be applied to whatever type of practice area you do. Maybe you'd have to contort it a little bit of the concept for litigation, but for a lot of legal practice that's doing the fractional work for like a business, whatever, and then industry specific. We've had the sports lawyer on. We've had provider legal who slots in this way for small medical practices, right? And the food lawyer who does it for businesses along the agricultural chain, right? So you know, there's all different ways that this type of approach to business can be done for lawyers and their clients too.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about the product itself, LawGood. So there's no reason not to. There'll be a link in the show notes.
For sure.
You could go make a free account, everyone listening right now, and follow along. And we were connected. Like, this is not a paid sponsored. We were connected through somebody else who I had interviewed. The name escapes me right now. Do you remember who it was? I forget.
Yeah, it was Overture folks, the folks from Biz Council and Overture.
Yes, Overture, who we've had on the pod. And and I have done a sponsored post for them on social
media.
Gotcha,
okay.
But I had them on the pod, and then they, you know, like, I was talking to them, and then they wanted me to do the sponsored thing. So everyone can make an account. It's really easy. And then when you're in there, you can see it's a very straightforward flow. So right, I'm just going through it. There's categories. I selected limited liability companies because that's something I do. I selected transfers for limited liability companies, which is a clause. You could pick governing law, I see here. And you have some jurisdictions, not just all states, but multiple jurisdictions beyond. I'm choosing, for the heck of it, professional services, because that's the business that I'm in. And then I'm presented with a clause right there, an A, B, C, D clause. It's got a bunch of different things highlighted in there. So the highlights, those are like the automations that are
part of it. Yeah. So what we do is, in the product, it's definitely on the freemium, it's more geared towards clauses. You could do a couple of different contracts or full agreements. On the product itself, it's definitely geared more towards kind of full contracts with a unique clause database as well. That's not just the clauses, like mostly in the freemium, it's certain set of clauses. It's a broader set in the product itself. But yeah, it's the highlighting that you mentioned. It's essentially geared. Those are orange and blue. And if we're the bracketed language in blue, things that you want to be able to fill out yourself. And the orange language is letting you know that from these clauses, these are would be considered defined terms. So if you're plugging them into the existing contract that you're using, remember to change these defined terms so that it is consistent throughout your document.
This is one of the things where, like, even if tools like this, like anyone could, you don't have to be a lawyer to go make an account on LawGood, right? But like being a lawyer is going to help you understand exactly what you just said, Liam, because if a non-lawyer heard that, they'll be like, defined term what?
Absolutely. I mean, it is a product geared towards lawyer. I mean, we're like the way we think about contracts, we kind of divide them up into, and this is kind of forms the backbone of the product. We think about contracts, breaking them up, kind of generally speaking, into three categories. So the bespoke language that the lawyer is always going to be drafting himself or herself from scratch, like an SOW or something along those lines, that's going to be very deal specific. The boilerplate language that is probably, even regardless of what kind of template you're pulling from or looking at, it's the language might change a little bit, but really the substance isn't going to change that much for that particular type of agreement. And then what we focus on, kind of the meat and potatoes of the contract, is what we consider mechanical language. So we further divide that into either highly negotiated mechanical language. So things like indemnification, the most highly negotiated clause in any document where lawyers make their money usually, or billable hour lawyers make their money usually, or structural mechanical language, things that are going to be very fact specific or deal specific, but aren't necessarily considered highly negotiated.
Right.
And so one of the things that I was always frustrated with when I was doing transactional research when I was in practice was, it was great. I would either pull from my firm's share drive, a starting point document, but then I was always researching on kind of one of the two main legal research platforms on their transactional section and trying to kind of compare paper. And I'd say, okay, I'll download this master service agreement. But then it was always kind of a neutral document, which by its very nature, that's fine. It's a good starting point. But then I was spending so much time having to go through and be like, okay, I have to make sure, like, I have to change each and every clause to really fit that my client's position for this particular deal very specifically. And so what we wanted to do is, for that mechanical language, make it really easy to kind of modify that clause language on the fly. So giving, we asked for a couple of inputs in the beginning, which are useful for us, the type of contract, the point of view of your client, if it's a kind of a negotiated document, not say like a privacy policy or something along those lines, but the point of view of your client. So like a contractor, service provider, or the company or the contractor, the industry and the geographic location. And then what generates is a document that's already tailored to those tags. So the goal is not to get the lawyer 100% of the way there out the gate, but about 70% of the way there. So not something just down the middle. And then allowing the lawyer to go through it on our platform and make any edits, filling out bracketed language, all that kind of stuff. But then on that, on those mechanical language clauses, the being able to either use a slider or a button to toggle through that language to be more or less in your client's favor, or to pick the particular situation that fits your client's needs for that particular deal or situation. So yeah, we wanted to make it really easy to kind of bring down the drafting time, at least to get 90% of the way there out the gate for a medium complex document in 30 to 40 minutes, as opposed to taking hours, which again, we found that certainly on the in-house side of things, people who aren't bound by oftentimes by the billable hour really have some incentive to getting these types of agreements off their plate quickly, so to remove bottlenecks. And then on the small firm side, we found too that you all know that a lot of smaller firm lawyers are dealing with cost-conscious clients. And so they've had to be more creative about how they can provide services for them. So subscription models or flat rate pricing. And so making it easier for lawyers who are doing those kind of innovative pricing models to say, well, it really makes sense for me. Like, I can charge this amount of money because I'm not spending 12 hours on a software master service agreement. I'm spending an hour on it, and I'm giving that client something that's really tailored. So if everybody's happy, really tailored to their situation and to fit their needs. So,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, when you say take 90% of the drafting work away, to me, that sounds like an amazing product because I'm not filling my time, right? So like, yeah. It's like in any other industry, you'd hear that and people would be like, fantastic. And in a billable hour profession, they go, I got to think about that, right? That's the mission of the podcast, and like what you're doing is so totally aligned. So I'm so glad to have you on the show and explain that and talk about it. And to those lawyers who are listening, I mean, like I do have some document like automation sponsors on the show, but they're very specific in their offerings, right?
Yeah.
And so like your product certainly overlaps a little bit with some of my show sponsors, but like it's its own totally different thing. And the price is different. And so like everyone has a different price point. Although I will tell you that one of my sponsors, 650, like they target in-house teams because yeah, like if you get the document, then like you're not spending time drafting it, right? And so it's a no-brainer market. And even in-house teams want options with like where they go, right? Like don't get me wrong, I love that they're a sponsor of the show, but also like they appreciate that not one product is right for every single customer or client.
Absolutely.
Something else that I like that I'm seeing on your page is, and just describing it, I'm like, since this is not like a screen share, even if I do post the video at some point, because it's an audio first podcast, even if I do eventually post the video, like I just like to describe it, is like the nice little just sliding bar underneath that's like, okay, it starts at neutral and then left to more favorable or less is less.
Less favorable. Over. Yeah. Less favorable is left. More favorable is right. And on average, there's for sliders, it's 3 to 5 positions usually. So there's a fair amount of variation there on the buttons. So the structural clauses, the buttons there, it can kind of run the gamut. It's 2 to, I think there's some contracts that we have up there. We're doing one on employee handbooks, for instance. That's a bit of a beast that has like ones that have 6-7 positions and things like that. But yeah, that's on sliders. It's usually, I would say it's 3 to 3 is for the most part, the most simple, and then 5 positions. So it's a neutral offering, kind of 1 degree more favorable or 1 degree less favorable, and then 2 degrees more favorable. So the most favorable option or 2 degrees less favorable.
I mean, and these are recommendations, but at the end of the day, the lawyer working the document can adapt it however they want.
Absolutely. Everything is editable. Yeah. The lawyer's always in the captain's chair.
Right. Right. And that's sort of similar, I think, to the whole generative AI movement, right? Like people are worried, oh, they're going to take lawyer jobs because people will just go to generative AI and say, draft me an indemnification agreement. Like it's not going to work that way. And I don't know, maybe Liam, if you could give us your perspective on that and maybe talk about some of the things in the works for LawGood too, sure. As we start to wrap up the interview.
Yeah, absolutely. So generative AI, it's everywhere now, and it's certainly in a lot of legal conferences and in legal publications. It is the talk of the day, and rightly so. It's super interesting. I find it super interesting, fun to play around with, but I'm of the camp that I'm a little bit more skeptical that it's going to certainly replace lawyers. In the short term, at the very least, it's not going to replace lawyers because the people who I think it is going to replace lawyers in the short term, it's my opinion that they either don't understand necessarily the technology very well or the legal profession or both. But yeah, I think that's right. It's in the same way that, you know, for instance, LegalZoom hasn't done away with the legal profession where people can go and get a legal template themselves and use that as their contract or the transactional profession, or the transactional part of the profession, that, you know, in the same way, I think certainly there will be people who will use something like a ChatGPT or a GPT-4 or any of the other open source models to try to create drafts for their documents. But I think for the average individual, in certain cases, it might work well, but for precision drafting, it's not quite there yet. And that's why you even have some of the bigger players currently, big legal publishers who are testing out kind of generative AI products, a lot of times limiting kind of their suggested use cases to kind of more simpler documents, not something like an engagement letter as opposed to an executive employment agreement or something along those lines. But yeah, it is super fascinating, but there's a lot of interesting companies out there. It feels like every day that someone else is plugging generative AI into their product. Sometimes there's a good use case for it. Sometimes there's not.
Look, I've demoed some software that claims to have AI and like it's nowhere visible and I don't see how their product has been improved by AI. I think they're just trying to jump on that marketing hype.
That's right. There's a lot of it. I think that was there's a lot of speculation that we're in. Is this a kind of a hype bubble or not? I mean, I do think there are some really interesting use cases. And there's some use cases that fit really well with, I think, what transformer models or large language models are really good at. There's been a bunch of companies that I think have plugged in through OpenAI's API access. Like at the time, it was just 3.5, GPT 3.5, which is like essentially ChatGPT. And now we're using GPT-4 through the API access to do a lot of summarization. LLMs are really great at summarization. And I think there's a lot of lawyers out there where they could benefit if they're reviewing hundreds of briefs or something along those lines or notices or whatnot. And there was a product that made it a lot easier to take a 10-page to however longer documents and break them down into a page of bullet points. That to me seems like it could be really useful for the legal profession.
Well, and here, just before we lose the thread, you brought up LegalZoom. And I think what that example tells us is clients are willing to pay something for legal advice, maybe just not the billable hour.
That's right. Right? Absolutely.
And so like you have to find the right pricing, but it's also the way you deliver those legal services. And so I see a really interesting opportunity for like me, like very specifically my law firm to offer as a subscription benefit, like a generative AI interface that is like trained specifically on legal stuff that I've helped train so that my clients have at least a certain level of expectation that if they're going to be doing something through the generative AI that they get by being a subscriber to me, that it's going to be better than just using one of those free tools out on the market that hasn't been trained on legal stuff. And then I can still come in and interface with it.
Absolutely. And I think that is certainly, I think up until very recently, it has been for certainly even larger organizations, it's been kind of a daunting task to think about how can the organization use the data that they're warehousing to make a language model work for their users or internal or what have you. And I think, I mean, everything's moving so very fast. I mean, I guess it's not even a year ago that really, or it's about a year ago that ChatGPT kind of broke onto the scene.
Yeah,
I think currently, it was just maybe the last week when this is filming, not to date an evergreen podcast, but I think that OpenAI has opened up kind of the ability for fine tuning. So kind of training with your own data, GPT 3.5. There's a lot of open source models now that it's easier to access because something like AWS Bedrock, where you have a lot of access to these different models, where it's kind of the last couple of weeks where people are like, oh yeah, there's maybe ways that I can take the data that I have, the kinds of contracts or the kinds of briefs that I've done, and try to make an out of the box model a little bit more fine tuned to what I might need it to do to my own data. And certainly there's other products that seem to be kind of coming down the pike around this, like that with Microsoft. I'm very interested in Microsoft Copilot, for instance, and kind of everything that it says it can promise to do, I haven't seen it necessarily in action myself, but it promises a lot that it also seems to be getting almost into the practice management space. If I can populate my own documents and have something natively in Microsoft Word, or pull down my contacts from Outlook and populate my documents or break them out into Excel really easily by just interfacing with something that's like Clippy, but a supercharged Clippy. I mean, that's a really interesting proposition in a big efficiency tool where I can, you know, if I were in practice, I would be able to do certain things that used to take me hours and would have been a pain in just a matter of minutes. But yeah, I think it's super interesting.
Certainly what I used to be able to give to an associate or a staff person and say, do this, do that. Now you could prompt your generative AI assistant to do this, do that, and have it done right away.
Yeah.
I mean, and even if it's not perfect and it's prone to hallucination, it's going to make, if you're not using it as a source of truth and you're providing the source of truth,
absolutely,
it's going to make far fewer mistakes than that associate or staff person ever would have.
And that's the other thing too, is I think what you just said there, where at least for the time being, where I find where it's doing kind of actions that are unknown unknowns is a little bit more where it gets a little bit hairier, because you can't double check it if you don't already know kind of what the output is supposed to look like.
Yeah, if you haven't read the whole internet and had a photographic memory, it might be hard for you to check generative AI's work.
That's right. But if you're asking for something where, you know, in certain cases where you're saying, look, I'm very comfortable kind of just like I would be comfortable editing someone else's first draft of an engagement letter or something, I can do that really quick. Yeah, it's a big time saver, and there's a lot of value there. And I know that the hallucinations are kind of a super interesting topic around precision research or drafting or what have you when it comes to the law. But just generally speaking, I find the whole thing super fascinating and interesting.
It's amazing because human beings are also prone to just make up stuff.
That's true.
Like our large language models so different than how the human brain actually works, because when we don't know things, we tend to just lie through our teeth.
I mean, we went to law school, right? I've definitely been in classrooms where people have been called on, and or in meetings where people have been called on, and they will talk about something that they definitely did not do the reading for.
The Great Gatsby is about a Gatsby that was great.
That's right. That's right.
So any things to tease for our listeners, knowing that this show does get published a little bit
in the
future?
We are working on our current product is not a machine learning generative AI product that's out there. It is not purported to be as such. But we are working on a special project now with a current partner where it makes it easier for specifically lawyers or legal professionals to interact with some of these different types of models, regardless of what the model actually is. So it kind of harkens back to essentially what we weren't really able to do with the first product offering with LawGood, just because the technology wasn't really there and we didn't have all the data that we needed. Large language models kind of make a lot of some of those pain points that we had with that first iteration of the product a lot less painful. And so we're seeing that we're actually able with, there's certain thing that large language models can be difficult for lawyers or really anybody to interact with for kind of multi-stage questions or analysis, where our project, and hopefully it will become a product, will make it a lot easier for getting kind of more out of these models, even ones that aren't specifically fine-tuned on legal data, because we can kind of essentially have the model learn in context, I guess, with the prompts, things like that.
Yeah. So it does kind of sound like, I'm going to engage in just a touch of journalism here. It sounds like it's pre-engineered prompt engineering is something that it sounds like you're working on.
It's pretty close to that. Yeah. Like it's exactly. It would be kind of generally speaking prompt templates in a way, but kind of the way exactly pre-engineered prompt engineering. I like that. I might use that actually, if you let me, you
could use it, but for what it's worth, if you go to legalpromptengineer.com, you're going to get me. Anyway.
Well,
yeah. So I hopped on that domain really fast. Liam, the last question I have for you, why everyone sticks around to the end of the show, is a hot dog a sandwich and why?
Is a hot dog a sandwich? I would say it is not a sandwich. No, it is a sandwich because you can have an open-faced sandwich. I'm not a huge hot dog person, although I was born in Chicago. I feel like I should be more into hot dogs than I am. But I would say, yeah, it's a sandwich because it's meat in between two pieces of bread, essentially, with a bun. So,
And if the bun is connected, you got an open-faced sandwich.
That's right, an open-faced sandwich, which I spoke without really thinking it through because I was like, wait a second, open-faced sandwich, exactly.
So now I have to ask a rare follow-up question that has been asked a few times before. Based on that logic, is pizza a sandwich?
Is pizza a sandwich? Well, I'd say no, just because this is going to be...
What if you slice up a hot dog or sausage and then put it on a pizza?
Put it in and then roll it together because then it becomes a calzone, right? So it's just... I mean, I would have to, my Italian is not great. So is a calzone a sandwich? Is a calzone a sandwich? Oh man, I feel like it's a losing answer. Whatever I say, it's going to upset some people. I'm going to have to say no, a calzone is its own thing. Can I explain the logic behind it? 100% no. My reasoning.
Right, hot dog, a sandwich, maybe even an open-faced sandwich, pizza, that's where you draw the line.
I got to draw the line there. But you'll have to have me on again, and I'll have to think about it to really give you some of my reasoning.
I do want you back after you're further along in the next project. But until then, where can people find you?
Yeah, I mean, you can certainly find me on LinkedIn. That's probably the best way to reach out to me. You can email me at liam@lawgood, LAWGD.io, or certainly find me on LinkedIn. I'm there, and I will. If you reach out, I will certainly respond. So I check it every day.
Liam, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me. It was great.
And that's our show. Thanks again to 650 and Gavel for being sponsors. The best way for others to discover this show is for you to share it with somebody you think would find value from it. Follow me on LinkedIn, since that's where I'm most active on social media, and click the bell towards the top right of my profile to get notified about all of my posts about this podcast and everything else I think is valuable for you to see. To get in touch, message me on LinkedIn or email kurbis@lawsubscribed.com. All links are in the show notes. Until next time, this is Matthew Kurbis with Law Subscribed.